So we've leapt ahead about 500 years. We're in Denmark now. He's Danish. This is sort of depressing.
I mean, one of the great sort of thinkers and productive philosophers of ever. Like when he was my age, he would have been dead for a couple of years.
That's sort of, no.
That's how you think about
it.
Yeah, I know exactly. So what I've done with my life so far, I think about Kierkegaard at my age.
Posthumous. He was, he died at 42.
Something like an illness, you know?
No, I don't know when he died. That's a good question. He always was a little sick. So I might have been a bit of a cow, but he always had a sort of a solitary oddball, Mr. Crow. He had sort of inherited a bunch of money. He just sort of this guy around town who wrote all this stuff, and people made fun of him. He looked sort of funny. I don't know. It's nothing like some stunning, spectacular, heroic death in some sort of war or something like that. Like Socrates, you know, going down with the hemlock. That's not good for me. All right, so I'm going to continue this theme of this idea of of interpreting ourselves. The idea is that we make sense of ourselves. We come to know ourselves by telling stories about ourselves, by thinking about ourselves. And this thinking is an act of interpreting. And the interpreting takes the form, I got this from yesterday, it takes the form of answering the question, where have I come from and where am I going, right? And that's the story we tell about ourselves to make sense of ourselves. I'm jumping ahead now about 1,500 years from where we ended up yesterday. We're flying through to a Danish philosopher, theologian, and writer, Søren Kierkegaard, or if you came from St. Olaf, where they've got the largest Kierkegaard Research Center in all of North America, it's Kierkegaard. Good sort of Scandinavian onto to it, but no, we're going to say Kierkegaard today. He's Danish. Most of his writing came in just this massive burst of manic energy from about 1841 to 1846. Published a dozen books over that time. And almost all the famous books you hear of Kierkegaard came out during that 5 or 6 year window. He got a theology degree, but then had so little confidence in the Danish church to actually produce Christians that he decided that this was not the course of path he could take. The questions that sort of plagued Kierkegaard's whole life, first of all, what is it to be a Christian? Fantastic question. Also, what is it to be an individual? Maybe that's sort of the question. His gravestone, I don't know how he does, but his gravestone says, Søren Kierkegaard, that individual. Right, so we thought, you know, the greatest thing you can aspire to in your life is to be an individual. And it's not automatic, he thinks. Right? It actually takes a tremendous amount of work and accomplishment to become an individual. And not only do most people not even accomplish becoming an individual, most people don't even try, don't even know they should try. This is what he thought was part of the curse of the time, is that people didn't even realize there was something to become called an individual. He thought this was part of the nature of the society of the time. That there was no longer any sort of pressure in the culture to aspire to something called being an individual. And that's something I want to talk about today. I'm going to leave more time for discussion today than last time. I mentioned this the first day, that one of the main themes over the course of the week is this idea that in conversation you come to discover things about yourself and about what you're talking about that you never would have come up any other way. And it's not just that you hear different things from different people that open your eyes to different ways of thinking, but you hear yourself talking. When you articulate something in a new setting to new people, a new context, every time it comes out a little bit differently. And you often find yourself learning things from hearing yourself talk. It's sort of a strange experience, right? You sort of look, wow, I never knew I thought that, but there it is, right there. I just heard myself say it, so it must be what I did. So I want to leave more time for discussion today. So I'm going to talk more too about topics that are more amenable to discussion. Now, Kierkegaard, the way he wrote, he wrote it just for philosophers, massively frustrating. He's extremely literary. He wrote many of his books that are written under pseudonyms. He published them under pseudonyms. So one of the classic books called Either Or, which I'm going to talk more about than anything else, was officially authored, not even authored, officially edited by someone named Victor Eremita. And that's sort of the name he gave to the editor. And there was a long preface that stated that this guy just found all these letters in a desk. And the letters were from this judge, and we don't have his name. And the letters are to a young man. And then he found these scraps and notes and things from this young man, including a diary. And he didn't know what to do with them, but he was so fascinated by them, he put them together into a book where the first half is all the writings of this young man, and the second half is all these letters of this judge. And none of it's true. It's all Kierkegaard. But no one knew this at the time, right? This book was just published. It was this huge splash. Part of why it was so successful is the sort of fragments of writings and jottings and journals and diaries of this young man map out a picture of a kind of life that Kierkegaard calls the ascetic life. It has this sort of young spirit of just embracing all experiences that come your way in life, right? Living fully in the moment. You can sort of picture someone, you know, this young with this idea, living fully in the moment and immersing yourself in sort of the richness of every experience, no matter what may come your way, right? And just letting life overwhelm you and taking it all in as much as you can. And so it just is this wonderful romantic sort of, you know, just... yeah, immersing yourself in the moment, sort of life. It's not, and it didn't matter what path it took. What mattered is how you let the past sort of overflow you, and you suck the marrow out of every moment, right? This is how. And then Seducer's Diary has him in this relationship then, and you can see how sort of manipulative he is in the relationship, because he's never really in the relationship. There's no such thing as commitment in this kind of life, right? There is just sort of this floating, and he needs to give this person the idea that he's committed to them in order to make this a real relationship, but he never is, because that violates his very sort of spirit of allowing change to come upon him at any moment to take a different path, right? And then the second part, the judge, is this condemnation of this life is lacking a proper seriousness. So he's a judge. This is either or. And the whole time you're thinking, but what does Kierkegaard think? And you want to say, what is his view? And you're three or four people away from who even Kierkegaard might be. Because not only is he not the judge, it's an editor who's edited. So he can be a very frustrating read, but he's brilliant, fantastically literary, and full of great quotes. So one of the great quotes I start with is this quote where he says, we understand backwards. But live forwards. And he said, and this is the problem of any attempt to really fully understand yourself and to go forth based on this understanding of yourself. There's always a little gap between what you've done, what's happened before, and what comes next. And he says, and the truth is, what comes next could be very different than anything that came before. Right? At any moment, you may change your life. You have that sort of flexibility, that sort of freedom. Right? Things may change. Now, I always, you know, give examples to my students. So every now and then someone takes me out, I say, you know, right now in the middle of this class, you could get up and walk out of here and never return to college. Right? And it's like, wow, yeah, I can. That's right. You know, it's never occurred to them, right? Your path could change completely, right? Your story could take a turn in this moment. And everything before this is just prelude, right? The past is prelude. This is all up to where you are in this moment. And this moment, there's always this gap in the future, so that everything you understand about yourself never is going to give you enough to know exactly what to do next. Right? So this is the sort of first great Kierkegaard idea. So the story about the interpretation you held about yourself that tells you where you come from and where you're going, Kierkegaard is going to say, it's the where you're going part that really matters. That's the part that really makes all the difference. Because where you're going will retroactively tell you the where you've come from part. It's in the moment of choice that you come to see where you're going. And then you look back and say, and now I know where I came from, because now I can see where my trajectory is. But the trajectory is always in that moment, and in that moment where you make the choice, and you have to make a choice. Actually, he says, you don't have to make a choice. This is maybe the first thing. He says, you should be making a choice. Yes. You should be making a choice. The problem is, he says, it's easy not to. He has a great... And it's easy not to take choices seriously. He has an analogy of, he's got parables all over the place. He's got a parable of a helmsman on a ship who knows he has to make a choice about when to come about, right? But deliberates and deliberates and deliberates and is oblivious to the fact that the ship is still moving, right? To the point where there's no longer a choice to be made, right? And he says a lot of people live this way. Rather than making the choice, you just hang on and hang on until the choice has been made for you. And there's something actually sort of comforting in that, right? It's something a lot easier and Troy's making for you. There's a writer who's writing a generation after Kierkegaard, Dostoevsky. Fyodor Dostoevsky, the Russian novelist. Mm-hmm. And in one of the novels, I'll just give you a small slice of this, because I don't want to ruin anything in this novel in case you ever want to read or have read it. In The Brothers Karamazov, there's a fictional scene where a grand inquisitor is just burning someone at the stake, right? And Jesus comes back again. And the grand inquisitor goes to Jesus and said, "You can't come back again." Right? Your message was people have to freely choose you to follow you. Right? But you don't understand. Freedom is not what people need. Freedom's too much to ask of people. What people need are burnings. They need miracles. They need ritual. They need hand-holding. You know, freedom is the greatest curse you could have given them, not the greatest blessing. So it's like wow, right? This sort of blow-your-mind confrontation with Jesus and a grand inquisitor. And part of the point is that freedom is the biggest burden you could put on them. And the greatest gift is what we are giving them, which is no choice. We're forcing them to follow this path by the sword and by burning people who don't and by making them. But that's part of this idea, too, is that there's a certain sort of comfort in not having to make the choice, because with the choice comes responsibility, especially if you have this problem where nothing ever quite gives you enough to know that the choice you're making is the right choice. This is why, that if there's one phrase from Kierkegaard that has everyone knows, it came from a little earlier, but he really made it the center of his life, is that you can only live life as a leap of faith. And it's got to be a leap. You can't think yourself into faith. You can't understand this is the direction of your life. All you can do is take that leap. So that's the first significant Kierkegaard idea I wanted to talk about. What he'll say, I've got a couple of quotes here that are pretty amazing. He'll say that what matters, he says, the choice itself is what's decisive for a personality's content. In choice, personality immerses itself in what is chosen, and when it does not choose, it wastes consumptively away. He thinks you only can be an individual by making choices. You only come to even have a self at all by making choices. He'll say that in choice, it is less a matter of choosing correctly than of the energy, earnestness, and feeling with which one chooses. He calls it the passionate subjectiveness of the choice. It is the earnestness, the intensity of the choice that is what is the most important thing of the choice. He says, the mother of all sins is not willing deeply. I like that. Kierkegaard is a very passionate fellow. And he has another parable. It's a parable of a knight. So there are these two warring city, I don't know what it is, you know, two warring...
factions.
Factions, yeah. The knight is deciding between the, I don't know, kings or something like this, right? And the knight comes to town, and both the kings try to hire the knight to join their side. That's how it works. And so the knight sort of goes with the highest bidder and fights for that side, gets captured right away and put in jail. And he gets to jail and says, okay, well, I'll work for you now. I'll accept your offer to fight for you. And the king says, everything's changed. Right? You can't make the choice and think things are still the same. And Kierkegaard is going to say, that's what it means to make a choice, is you recognize things are not going to be the same. Right? There's no sort of retreat back and say, well, that didn't work out. Right? And if you don't have that sort of passionate inwardness, don't have that energy, that inertia, then it's not a real choice. Right? It doesn't have any life to it. It certainly can't be the kind of choice which is an answer to the question of where are you going. You know. Okay, so that's the first Kierkegaard idea. The second Kierkegaard idea I want to talk about is that it's not obvious that people make these choices. Right? This is what I want to say. It is actually, and Kierkegaard's very concerned about this, that you could live your whole life without really making these choices, in the same way that you could live your whole life without really thinking about who you are and where you're going and where you come from, without really trying to articulate your life, without really deciding what are the real guiding values in your life, where do they come from, why have you made them your values, why do they reflect who you are, define who you are, right? It's possible to go through life without any of that. And Kierkegaard thinks more than that. He thinks that society, now this is Denmark in the mid-19th century. He says, society is a society of leveling, where all values are just out in the open. He calls it like a marketplace of values, where you can just go in and take something off the shelf and buy it and try it on, and there's nothing is understood to be truly important any longer. So there's no longer any social, societal pressure which says, you need to commit. You need to make a choice. You need to be passionate. So this is no longer a passionate age. This is an age where everything is held as if it was for sale, on sale, easy to buy, and you never need to think about how hard it might be to live if you buy it. So the second thing he says is we live in a society where no one is encouraged any longer to live this sort of life where you become an individual. And then one question is, well, how do you get that society? How do you become a society? Has it gotten worse? This is one of the things I'm curious about. There have been a few articles written about how the internet is a perfect example of Kierkegaard's leveling. Mm-hmm. You know, where you can be whatever you want online, and you can go this place, you don't like it, go that place. There's no sense in which something takes on part of your identity so that there's no going back. So you realize that this is a future. So that's the second big Kierkegaard idea I want to talk about, I want to mention for the sake of the discussion. What he says about leveling, he says, with the idea of leveling comes the idea of, he calls it the public, but it's just the sense of, it's what one does. You know, this is just what one does. And it's a way in which you sort of live your life just doing what people do. This is what, you know, there isn't doing, it's what they say, you know, this is what one does. There's no, like, anyone behind it. It's just sort of following along with the crowd, and the crowd moves forward, and Nietzsche called this the herd. And you get sort of sucked up in the herd, and there's a momentum and inertia to the herd, and it carries you through your time, and that's it. Yeah.
Did he give examples of kinds of choices that you're referring to, or people
yes.
who live that way?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, he gave examples of kind of choices. One kind of choice, one sort of life. He had sort of different basic big categories. So one kind of life he called the ascetic life, which is what I talked about. This idea of sort of immersing yourself in the full-blooded richness of experience. And you can see someone trying to make that sort of the source of the meaning of their life. He wanted to say that is not actually a choice. That is a fleeing from choice. He said that's the making the most out of your life possible if you never actually take responsibility for living. It's purely reactive, purely sort of, are you looking for actual, real, like this person? Or are you thinking just in general categories? I realize that if you're going to general categories, maybe that's not what you want. But I can give you some.
Well, I mean,
yeah.
You make a choice to be a criminal, let's say.
Right.
Is that a good example of making a choice and understanding yourself and being an individual?
Well, would Kierkegaard consider that a choice? No. But you want to say, what? But he says what matters is the passionateness, right? It can be whatever you want. It's about being a passionate criminal. Here's what he says. He says the very idea of choosing has to, if it's a serious choice, it also has to take seriously the idea of choosing. It's a sort of a complicated thing, but if you're going to say this choice is important, and I'm going to make this choice, I'm going to live this choice.
Well, you make a choice to be a farmer.
Yes.
I'm passionate about being a farmer.
Yeah.
You know, is that a good example of what he was talking about?
Is that enough for Kier? So here's I'm trying to figure out how much part of the story to give away too, right? So this is, but this is something you're talking about. One question is, can any choice fulfill a life? Can any choice make you an individual, if that's the story? Now, part of it depends on I guess, how you're a farmer. I mean, there's a way in which maybe you grew up in a farming family and it just made sense. Yeah. You're a farmer, right? You just were born into this life.
No, I'm not a farmer.
I know. I'm trying to say part of it is the way in which you take on this life, whether you take it on as a choice and you've made it your own, all right? Part of it is whether it has the sort of characteristics it needs to be a life that makes you an individual. I don't know. I mean, why not, right? So here's the question. What is it about the life that makes an individual life? So you might say, well, what is it about you that makes you an individual? Is it your particular likes or dislikes or your particular, I mean, Here's one of the big Kierkegaard arguments, one of the big concerns he has. All choices ultimately reveal deep moral values. If it's a real choice, there's a moral value behind it. You think this is right. This is a right way to live. This is a moral way to live. Someone else, any choice I make is a choice that I recognize would be good for another kind of person in this situation as well, right? Now, this is why I'm glad he went to farming rather than thieving or whatever the person was, right? So I recognize there's something noble in this life of farming, that in choosing this, I'm also deciding I couldn't condemn someone else for following the same path, right? What Kierkegaard is going to say about moral values is that it belongs to the nature of morality that it's impartial. Morality is never about you. Morality just says this is what one should do. And you just happen to be in that situation. It doesn't ever make you a specific individual to be moral, because it's what we all should do. So yeah, now wait a minute, right. Now this becomes all of a sudden, this is one of the sort of the big arguments from Kierkegaard, is that morality won't make you an individual. Morality will just put you in a position of doing what someone does, what someone should do. And it's, in fact, it's antithetical to morality to be an individual, to stand out, to be an exception, right? What is sort of violates the principles of morality, except to think of yourself as an exception to morality. Think there are rules that apply to you that don't apply to anyone else. So even Kierkegaard's going to say, a life which is built around good moral values isn't a life that's going to make you an individual. Because these aren't individual values. There's nothing about you as a unique person in these values. Right?
Then I would want to be a criminal.
Yeah,
so yeah, you can go with the criminal. Yeah, the criminal doesn't have it either, right? Criminals are criminals.
On the other hand, if you're coming from a family of criminals,
yeah, that's right.
Then if you're living a moral life, then you're an individual. I don't know how to say this. From a mafia family.
Yeah.
All your uncles and all cousins, everybody is a criminal.
Yeah.
And then you try to live a moral life, then you will be an individual, right? Is that right?
For Kierkegaard?
Mm-hmm.
No.
No.
You're not yet an individual, Margaret. This is truly one of the more extreme thinkers in the history of philosophy. So at that point, you want to say what? You want to say, yes, you've chosen this life, you made this life your own.
Yeah.
Right? There's a way in which, you're making the life that you've made is not different in that respect from anyone else's life who's being moral, because you're all just doing the right thing.
Well, who's to say? I mean, who's the judge of whether you're an individual? Aren't you yourself?
Okay, well, this now becomes an issue, right? Right. On what grounds are you judging yourself to be an individual?
Right.
Yeah, what is it that makes you an individual? Where does your individuality lie? Now, if you go with me what I said at the start, if you're going to grant me that individuality is not automatic. It has to be earned. You know, and then that many people aren't individuals. That you can't take it for granted that you are an individual. Then where do you look to find your individuality? Okay, so this is where it gets complicated, all right? This is what,
But I have a question.
Sure.
Is Kierkegaard admit to degrees of individuality? Is it
either or? Is it either or? What is a Kierkegaardian phrase? Kierkegaard, would he admit to degrees of individuality? I don't think so.
I mean, just leap from not being an individual, and then you make the right decision, and you're an individual?
Yes.
It is a leap.
There is. He doesn't have a problem with that, because those are just the kinds of things he thinks are going on. Right. Yeah, it's a full transformation of who you are, such that you now become an individual. Yeah. And the question is, what could do that? All right, okay. Wait, any questions?
Why should you?
That becomes another question. You know, why should we aspire to that? Isn't morality enough?
And if that choice is too painful, you might make a leap backwards, being a non-individual.
Right? Yeah. There must be the rewards and the choice that make it worthwhile. Because I said the temptations of not choosing are strong. Right? And there's a sort of relief in that, and there's a terrible burden. And yeah, go ahead.
Kierkegaard, understanding, doesn't God see us as individuals?
Well, this is where he's going to go with it. Yeah, exactly. Right, yeah. This is sort of where he ends up. Is that there's only one relation where you're recognized as an individual, and that's an individual relation to God.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what he wants to say in the end. But what's So that's sort of the story. And I would say, well, I didn't know if we want specific examples, because this specific example is, it makes things harder rather than easier. A specific example is Abraham. He said Abraham's an individual. And the reason why Abraham is the true hero of faith, because, and he's got a book called Fear and Trembling, and it's got an amazing beginning where he tells the story of Abraham and Isaac over again. He tells it four different ways. And the different ways are things where Abraham, so one is that Abraham was resentful at God for commanding him to kill his son. Another one is Abraham pretended to be possessed by the devil rather than let his son think that God would do this to him. I mean, they're all really plausible. Rather than let his son think that God wanted him killed, right, as a way to protect his son. They're all really sort of clever versions. And he wants to say, and none of those were the actual story. The actual story is God says, do this. Abraham gets up in the morning, you know, loads up the donkey or whatever and heads up the mountain, right? The ram gets substituted, the lion gets substituted, and he comes back down, and that was the end of it, right? And there's a sense in which Kierkegaard wants to say, what does it take to be the kind of person where you can just sort of say, well, I guess I'm going to kill my son. God said, kill my son. Well, here we go. And he says, that's the knight of faith. The
there's
one who
a lot
can
of maniacs in the society
yeah.
kill their children listening to.
So like I said, his example is one that makes things a lot harder than a lot easier, right? You think, well, that's a tough direction to go, right? And he wants to say that that Abraham's a paradox. That your moral responsibility, the greatest moral responsibility as a father is to their children.
When you say knight of faith, is that in as in despair?
Oh,
the
knight,
K as in the hero.
Yeah, the knight of faith. Yeah, so he's got two sort of stories about the way you can be religious. And one way to be religious, he calls it the knight of infinite resignation. Knight. This is a hero. It's like a tragic hero. You recognize that to live a life oriented to God is to recognize that, first of all, everything about you is sinful. Everything about this life is nothing compared to God. Right? He says it's going to live a life of infinite resignation where you realize that everything here is empty compared to what really matters. And he says, and that's an incredibly noble, you know, spiritual position to be in. But he wants to say the situation of faith is even higher. That's this passionate, it's not logical. It's the sense in which you've given up everything and still you think everything is just fine. Everything here is completely valuable. You know, I didn't plan on talking about Abraham and Fear and Trembling because it's such a tough story to think this is your model. Of the great individual. And the reason he's the model is because, as Kierkegaard says, he's above the ethical. He doesn't do it on some moral principle, do what God says, because that would just belong to the level of the ethical. We should do what God says. He does it because God called and he answered. And it's an individual relationship to God now. And that's what we're all called to have. So yeah, so it's tough to say, could the farmer be an individual? And part of what I say, yes, for Kierkegaard, but it's because of the farmer's relationship to God, right? Not because they're a farmer. Does that make sense? And then we have the level, okay, so now that I've put this on the table, I suppose I should, you know, what was my, I lost track altogether, I had four, what was the fourth one? That is the fourth one, not any choice will do. Oh yeah, the other one, I'll just put this up here, because now the leveling takes on a new story. The leveling turns out to be a story about a secular world. For Kierkegaard, it's the same story about why, as a seminarian, he decided not to join the church because he thought the church wasn't actually encouraging people to be properly holy. But the fourth one, and this is a really important idea, it's the idea that through our choices, and you don't have to go to the extreme route of Kierkegaard to talk about Abraham, but just think about this, it's only through our choices. Do we become a self at all? Do we even have something we can call ourselves is through our choices? So the analogy is this. I mean, there's a, you know, we say things like the wind blows. But it's really not the wind and the blowing. It's just the blowing. Right? There's not some other thing there called the wind, and every now and then it blows. Right? This is just a, we have this misleading way of talking. And when you think about a musical performance, it's not like there's the music and the performance. The performance is it. I mean, when it's, or a dance performance, you know, when it's not going on, when it's not being carried out, when it's not being performed, it isn't there. You know, it's just, you know, the score is not the music. It's the performance of the music. It only exists when it's brought to life through being acted out. And Kierkegaard wants to say that about us, too. We only really exist as selves when we're bringing ourselves to life and acting out our lives in reflective, choice-worthy ways. The rest of the time, we're not even selves. We're just sort of going along with things. And that's a really powerful way of thinking about yourself, because then it's not, if you're narrating your life, this is a story about telling a story about your life, then is not about capturing yourself. It's about creating yourself. It's about bringing yourself to life. It's about bringing a kind of person into existence. You know, it's not about getting yourself right so much as it is as creating a self for Kierkegaard. Okay, that was the last thing. So those are the four, and I thought these three ideas that would be more open to discussion about how to think about what it is to be an individual. Or even if that matters, right? I mean, this is one of the questions. Why is that a goal? Right? And you're thinking, now that I hear more about it, maybe it's...
I don't know if it is a goal.
It sounded good when you first said it, but now I'm thinking... Yeah.
I'm wondering to what degree he sees... I mean, in some sense, this sounds like a very modern... I mean, it's a very modern view, right? Like, that the individual is supreme, and that through, you know, the choices that we make, we realize that. But to what degree is he seeing that as a sort of, like, is he really seeing, imagining people kind of radically, like, stepping outside of social convention, or is he kind of talking about kind of claiming for oneself the position that you find yourself in?
He's talking about the latter, claiming for oneself the position you find yourself in. Though, so it doesn't have to be fucking authority or something like that, or being an individual. It's not being different.
It's not James Dean sort of.
Right, yeah, exactly, right. It's not like that. Being an individual doesn't mean being different from other people. Right.
Really? Doesn't mean being different.
From other, it doesn't, well, what do I, it doesn't mean breaking with convention. That's really what it is, right? Mm-hmm. Especially because we know, and this seems sort of obvious, there's standard ways of breaking with convention. Right? Breaking with convention doesn't automatically make you someone who's a great original sort of thinker. It means you've just sort of joined one of the standard ways of, you know, even those are just ways in which one does things, ways in which one rebels.
Right.
So, rebellion doesn't guarantee that you're an individual. Does that seem right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure.
But what is it? Okay, so what does it mean to aspire to be an individual? Right. Well, I think, don't we all already think that we're different? That there's something unique about us? That we're irreplaceable?
No.
That we're not substitutable?
Yes.
Right? And you do think that, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So on one hand, you sort of, to ask, well, so why would you want to be an individual? You say, well, aren't I already? And wouldn't it be sort of terror? Wouldn't it be awful to find out I wasn't? In the sense that, you know, I met someone and they said, oh, you know, you remind me just of this other friend of mine. And I meet that person and they're exactly like me. That would really be spooky, right? You know, I mean, they could never be exactly like me because they don't have the same wife and children, but in lots of ways they're exactly right. Yeah, but you know, they're sort of sort of a mirror image of your personality, right? That would be. We like to think that our personalities make us all individuals, and that's individual enough, right?
Where does low self-esteem fit into all that?
Oh yeah, I mean, for being an individual, yeah.
Yeah.
Kierkegaard didn't
suffer
from that, did he?
No.
he
didn't.
So if you're only an individual in your relationship to God,
that's characterized line, yeah.
How does that impact the way you live then, besides the choices? Which can't make you an individual.
I don't know that Kierkegaard thinks. When he talks about the knight, the K-N-I-G, knight of faith, he talks about, he says, imagine such a person, you would have, they would be indistinguishable from anybody else. They're an entirely ordinary person, but their whole life is different because they live it in a recognition of an individual relationship to God.
Mm-hmm. You're saying then their interior life is different.
Their
external sense, they may look like everybody does.
Right, the interior life is different. Yeah, there's obviously a kind of transformation. Yeah. Yeah, so what sort of things belong to this person? At the end of either or, there's a section. Actually, Kierkegaard, every time he sort of published one of these books under other people's names, these very literary things, he often published on the same day a series of what do you call Christian discourses or uplifting discourses. They're sort of stories or parables or things that would help to sort of guide your spirit. At the end of either or, the Pseudonymous work, he has a chapter called On the Edifying Idea That in the Face of God We Are Always Wrong. And the idea is this: if you think about yourself in the presence of God, you can't think of yourself as anything but sort of wrong, but existentially wrong, sort of nothing, right? Sort of a failure, a sinner. This is good Lutheran guilt stuff. He's a good Lutheran, right? And so if we can say something, go ahead.
It seems as though I think of us as becoming individuals with the, it seems like a critical thing is the way we spend our time, because as we go along, we're constantly making choices of, do I go this way or that way, do I think this or not? That's what makes us individual, and I doubt that there's anyone else that duplicates it. But that doesn't seem to quite meet his criteria.
That's not enough for him, right?
For
exactly.
Individuality, and I'm not sure why.
Because when you think about some of these choices, I mean, I think what Kierkegaard thinks, part of the leveling idea, is that he thinks that the choices that we're always encouraged to make are never the kinds of choices that actually create us as individuals. So you go to the grocery store and you choose one cereal over the other, and you choose one line over the other, and you choose where to park, and there's constant choices, but none of those choices are identity forming. None of those choices could answer the question, where have you come from and where are you going? You know? But there are all these little things you do throughout the day, but is that enough to be the constituents of a story about who you are?
Well, I would say yes.
That's it. Yeah, you want to say it? You want to say that's all there is. That is the story right there.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Abraham made the one choice, right, that made him an individual.
Mm-hmm.
Does that happen more than once?
Right.
Or are you constantly making those kinds of choices as you live your life?
So Kierkegaard will think that it only will happen once. And the way that this works, this is a whole other story of Kierkegaard, we're getting just stories about Kierkegaard here. He has a whole theory about this. He thinks deep down we all understand the anxiety about maybe not being a true individual. We understand a kind of anxiety that maybe our life is being frittered away by meaningless things, right? Little things, just sort of, you know, things that actually don't add up to anything, that are just taking up our time. And he thinks we all sort of feel this, and he calls this despair. It's this sense that we may not. Is this okay up there with Kierkegaard people? Despair? Okay, good. Yeah. Oh, you put people, I would say Kierkegaard, they cheered. I thought, wow, despair. We all live in deep despair. And he says, and the more you think about the ethical life, the more you think about whether you're being as moral as you could be, the more you despair. And the more you think about whether you're being as religious as you could be, the more you despair. And the more you think about God and your place with God, the more you despair, right? I mean, he thinks that the path to God is a path of ever deepening despair, but making the leap of faith is handing this despair over to God. It's letting God becomes this grace, you know, God becomes the gift of individuality. As long as you think your individuality is up to you, it's all despair. If your individuality is up to God, then you're freed from despair, and he thinks, and you'll never go back, because you know what it was to live in despair.
Did he ever talk about when in life that is likely to happen because a young person compared to a person with lots of experience, same outcome?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine a young person. I mean,
so
I think
all
there's a
young
reason.
People are not individuals.
I think that's right. Especially when you put it like that. I'm like, yeah, actually, is that right?
I mean, this how old do you have to be?
Well, I mean, that would be a surprising thing. I mean, there's a sense in which, of course, they're individuals, right? Each have their own personalities and things. And there's another sense in which, no, you know, how can you be an individual unless you really have this is what I want to say. How can you be an individual unless you really have a story about your life to tell? And how many young people have a story about their life to tell? That
Justin Bieber.
Yeah, Justin Bieber. Sorry about that. Has been told by lots of people and on Twitter and 140 things like that. Right, yeah. Right, because I mean and for good reason. You know? So I would think that he would certainly say, and he might be right about that, right? What do you think about that idea that you only can become an individual if you really have a story about your life to tell? If you really can answer the question, where am I going?
But there are points at which there's not much choice. I'm thinking a woman conceives a baby.
Right.
Well, at least in my experience, there wasn't a whole lot of choice there.
Yeah, sure.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, your life is committed forever, and it doesn't stop at when the child becomes 18 either. So
right, exactly.
We all know your life has changed.
Yep.
In some ways, you had something to do with it, but very little.
Right. Yes. No.
So there are these points where you are propelled because of circumstances or because of other people's choices.
Right.
And.
Yeah.
I don't see how that should condemn you to lack of individuality in the sight of God.
You know, that's good. You're absolutely right. I don't think Kierkegaard thinks it does condemn you. The judge's first example to the young aesthete is marriage. But you could never, in this sort of live for the moment, you could never love, you could never understand marriage. You could never understand what a commitment is, where you don't know where it's going. But you know that this is going to be who you are now. And this is children, right? There's no going back. Going back is just another way of being a parent.
Right.
You know, there's no way to not stop being a parent at this point. And this is why Scott's point is important, that it's not about having freedom of choice to do all sorts of things. It's about coming to also freely, coming to sort of choose your situation, to own your situation. To take responsibility for who you are in your situation. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I mean, I think he would say that too. But Kierkegaard famously got engaged and then walked away from the engagement and dwelled on it for the rest of his life and trying to figure out why it was he was incapable of getting married and whether this was all about a lack of, you know. So he's not a good example for this. Yeah, go ahead.
The choices that would make an individual, does he believe that they're the thing that the day I was saved, the day I was reborn, when I made the leap of faith and decided to give my life to Christ, these kind of decisions?
It would depend. I think it would depend on how it gets lived out, you know? Because there's lots of ways in which I think one thing Kierkegaard will say, I know he'll say this, is you don't know when you've made the choice until well afterwards.
The follow through.
Yeah, exactly. And that's certainly, marriage is a good example, right? You never know how committed you are until after the marriage actually lasts, right? Everyone thinks they're committed when they get married, but whether in fact you made that commitment only, I mean, really what's going on is a commitment is just the commitment to keep making the commitment, right? It's sort of, I'm going to reaffirm this choice constantly or something like that, right? The commitment's only as good as it continues. And when it doesn't, then the commitment wasn't there from the start or something like that. And the same, so I think he would say it's something simple. Does that make sense? A sort of analogy. It's not just about the moment, then it's about the way in which it's lived. Is that fair? Yeah. Yeah, is that?
It seems like we're talking, and I think a confusion is, it seems like it's on one level, But there are really many levels within this. So yes, you have a child and you have, in one sense, no choice. Mm-hmm. But you have many, many, many choices all the time,
right,
about how you relate to that child. Or,
right.
Sure. You know. So I think that's where you either every choice is in relation to God or or not. And that makes it a difference. And so there's the fundamental choice in relation to God, and then everything else fits into that.
Right.
Rather than the other, we seem to all be thinking about it a lot the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not, you can live a marriage or anything at any number of levels.
Sure.
And you don't necessarily know what you're doing, as you said, until way
down the line. Yeah, you find out later.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Good. Yes.
Said that you only could get be an individual in your relationship to God. Why not to the devil?
Yeah. Why not to the devil? I think, Kierkegaard thinks that it's a matter of grace, and the devil doesn't offer grace.
Are we sure?
What's that?
Are we sure?
Yeah, we're sure. Yeah, I wasn't, yes.
They say that.
And the devil's incapable of offering grace. Because the kind of infinite gift that grace bestows is incapable of anything but an infinitely good being. That's why we're incapable of grace. We can be gracious, we can be generous, but we can't have the sort of... So that's, I think that's the theology line. I don't know how different the theologians in the room, but I think that would be the answer, that the devil's incapable of it. Yeah, sure.
I just listening a bit to you talking about there's one choice, you know, kind of a defining moment is that Kierkegaard believes. And I'm thinking about a person like Bill Gates, Bill and Melinda Gates, who made a decision to change their life.
Yeah.
And now they're experiencing.
Sure.
The event that they made, and now they're experiencing it in life. Or I think of Jimmy Carter.
Mm-hmm.
And how is he going to be remembered? In my opinion, he won't be remembered as president.
Mm-hmm.
He will be remembered for the decision that he made to carry on for humanity, all the many worthy things he has done post-presidency.
Yeah, right. I think for Kierkegaard, the first point is that you need, most, a lot of people don't ever make that choice. Now, Jimmy Carter and the Gates have opportunities of choices that some of us don't.
But look at Albert Schweitzer, for instance. Mm-hmm. A doctor.
Right.
And how do we remember him? Not that he was a country doctor. No.
Right.
The great things he did.
Sure.
With his medical practice.
Yeah.
As a mission.
Right.
Position.
Yeah. They made a choice, or they said, what am I, at some point they said, what is really important in my life, and how is my life going to reflect that from now on? That's the question of, where am I going? Right.
Jimmy Carter could have gone back to this peanut plantation
and
had his ongoing business, but no, he probably still owns his plantation, but what has he done with his life?
Yeah, no, and those are great examples. And I think Kierkegaard's first point is you need to ask that question. At some point, you need to, at maybe many points, you need to sort of say, what is really important? How am I going to live my life to reflect that? And he's going to say, at that moment, you don't always know exactly what that best answer is. And it gets borne out in the living of it. You know, Jimmy Carter learns what it is to run this foundation only by doing it, and then he finds out really what it means. I think that Kierkegaard thinks a lot of people don't. A lot of people don't even realize they're not. They think they're doing it, and they're not. And I think part of it is that Kierkegaard thinks there's a level of seriousness to the question that people don't realize, what it means to commit yourself to a choice once you make it, something like that.
Does he think a lot of people are?
No. That's the other thing. I think he thinks a lot of people have made that choice, are individuals.
Yeah.
No.
He doesn't think there are very many individuals.
No, but he was that might just be a personality. He was misanthropic, and he was he really didn't like people, and he was sort of a curmudgeon, and really sort of a real pessimist. Dana, I mean, you called the father of existentialism for this sort of brooding darkness that some people love. Go ahead. What is it? Yeah, what
was I was just going to say, I think he thinks or thought that the vast majority of the population is walking around in kind of this blind haze. Mm-hmm. That they, in a sense, were thought that they were hitting the target or
right.
getting close to the target, but in that way were so far off the target that even more so because they tried so hard to...
Yeah.
To make that choice, but then they didn't even know that the choice was there to be made.
Right, they didn't even know
what
this really involved. Yeah, to even make this choice, and they're so self-satisfied with what they took to be enough that they never were likely to even realize they weren't getting there. Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
Yeah. So Kierkegaard being critical of any sort of Christian ritual or social ritual, and then along with that. I mean, what role is there in social development, meaning, like, you know, language with which we express ideas is socially developed, consciousness is socially developed.
Yeah.
Does the individual have to pick apart kind of all the social construction to be an individual?
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I don't think he thought enough about language. I mean, because the way in which you articulate your life and tell your story, this is language, right? And these are... They involves all sorts of ideas and values and terms and ways of speaking that you've inherited. And it's very easy to think that it's very easy to imagine a society which just doesn't have the right kind of vocabulary for helping people to live the most fulfilled lives because of the ways in which they tend to think in terms of, and you're encouraged to think in terms of. So I don't think Kierkegaard thought very much about that, but I think he did think that any time in which you rely on a ritual to do the work for you, you're failing to become an individual. That's maybe part of it. But yeah, I think he, Kierkegaard, but you know, if you, so you got all the ways in which you're shaped by your society, right? But if you have God doing the work, then you've got the greatest out anyone's ever thought of, right? The most transcendent being imaginable, making possible your individuality, then you don't have to worry about it as much. Anything less than God, it's more of a problem. Right? If you say, well, where I'm really going to hitch my wagon in order to be an individual is you know, some notion of development, third world development, right? And you may find yourself accidentally, inadvertently being sucked up into different versions of colonialism. I mean, it becomes very complicated. Anything less than God is fraught. Is that okay?
Is that okay?
I mean, is that what I mean by that? Is that the sort of thing that is an answer to what you're asking? Not whether you agree with that. I just want to make sure I'm actually hitting the question right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
I guess I'm curious about his injunction to serve the neighbor. I don't know a ton about Kierkegaard, but I thought that one of the reasons he didn't marry had to do with the fact that he thought that the fundamental act was to serve the neighbor, and if you're paying attention to an individual other than in the name of serving the neighbor, that was idolatry in a way.
Right.
But then some of the examples you were just giving, you know, to go help third world countries or whatever is not necessarily...
Serving the neighbor?
Yeah. But I'm thinking about
I think it is serving the neighbor. I mean, the neighbor is not the person next door.
How does his desire to tell people the one thing you have to do is to serve your neighbor fit into this, the one thing that has to happen is that you choose God, or you give your passion to God?
How does it work together?
Make sense? Yeah.
I think the way it works is that by willing to be an individual before God, you're also striving to be the kind of person that follows, you know, God's commands, and then the greatest command is love your neighbor as yourself.
So that's a very Martin Luther kind of approach.
Perhaps.
Like serve God because of God's grace.
He was
willing to earn it.
He really emphasized serving your neighbor because he was worried about the ways in which, and he talks about neighbor as being just simply the other in need. He was worried about ways in which specific relations to other people is a kind of, ends up being sort of selfish. So he's worried about whether if your friend is another you, then serving your friend is really sort of self-serving. So prioritizing the people who are close to you becomes a form of self-servingness. And so there's kind of anonymity, he thinks, that goes with serving your neighbor. It's a hard moral. I mean, the idea that I can't sort of privilege my wife over because, you know, hard to blame you for that.
Do you think part of that is justification of his own, you know, his biography?
Yeah. I don't think that part is, but I think a lot of other things are. Yeah. I mean, he talks about that, the marriage thing a lot. I think that is, I mean, I don't think that part is part of that. I think he was very concerned about the ways in which, I think he's a very passionate person, and he thinks that we need to be passionate in our choices and in our lives, in our commitments. And so he is very worried about temptations of passions that might lead to the wrong kinds of priorities. So the passions of intimacy, of friendship. I think that's what's going on. Some passions are worse, are more problematic than others when you're a champion of living passionately. So that's my thinking. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'm just trying to think of this in real life.
What the heck?
Well, we were in Allison's today. We were to remember the house we grew up in.
Oh, good, yeah.
Okay. I'm thinking about my mom grew up in one kind of house, I grew up in another, and I'm sitting with my daughter knowing, you know, I barely had one bedroom and, you know, or one bathroom, and it just kept getting better. So is that the leveling, that without really thinking about it, we kept going higher, and in the end, we used too much of the world's resources, and we aren't thinking about our neighbors in the other countries, and...
I think.
I mean, in a way that is sort of. I didn't make conscious choices. I was just following my life the way I sort of thought that it should go.
Yeah, sure. That's
so
part
in a way
of the leveling.
That isn't an individual.
That's it. Exactly. Yeah. That's what someone really should try to do, right? Just have.
And even though I was
moving
trying
the house
to
with more bathrooms,
what I wanted to
yeah,
do,
yeah.
but it,
yeah.
in a way, it was following the crowd.
Yeah. Exactly. You didn't even have to think about it, really. It just seemed obvious this is what you're striving for. But when you do think about it, you know that can't really be what's important. Right?
Right. Yeah.
Well,
yeah. So, now at this stage of my life, I'm kind of wondering about it.
Now that your daughter gets to enjoy the benefits,
yeah,
you're like, wait a minute, maybe she's spoiling her, and I don't know, there was this sort of thing. But yeah, I think, but part of his point of leveling, too, is that these are the things that take up most of our time and energy and thoughts and sort of, you know, how can I make sure I get the house with the most bathrooms? And I spend a lot of time on the market trying to find it, and it's like, you know, that can't be the most important use of your time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Fair. Yes, ma'am.
What was his purpose in writing these? Just to get all these thoughts out of his system? Did he want to reform and change the church as it was that day? Do you
want
to get people to thinking?
I think all three of those. I think he was, I mean, some people are just kind of obsessive writers. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to imagine this sort of productivity. I mean, there are just thousands and thousands of the pages that came out in 5 years. I mean, things were in kind of a mania of a kind of, you know, it's just a sort of a, there's a word for it, a kind of hypergraphia or something like that. He just wrote immensely creative. I think that he is very funny, too. In the history of philosophy, there are certain figures that really make their mark by mockery and humor. And he spent a lot of time making fun of very famous philosophers and really making them look ridiculous and helping people to get over them, not by refuting them, but seeing how absurd these views are. So we can move. Let's get down to earth, right? This is just silly. You know, you just get a lot, you know. So part of it is to get people to think, and part of it is to try to break, I think, how about this? For him, I think it was sort of therapeutic. I think he was hoping he was breaking, by reading this, you would break out of habits of thinking. So it's sort of therapeutic, and then it's now a new way of seeing. It's a very extreme position that focus on individuality, that focus on high, something that's higher than morality, which is really scary, you know? And that's where a lot of people say, wait a minute, Kierkegaard, I don't know that we want to start encouraging everyone to aim above morality for the sake of your individual relation to God, because that's where you get, right, the people hear the voices, God told them to do things. But I think that he saw it as, trying to shake things up. It certainly was. I mean, it became very well known in Copenhagen for his writing. He eventually owned up to all these pseudonymous writings and was very well known for his books and his writings in Denmark at the time. He didn't become really famous philosophically or theologically until the early 20th century. Almost no one read him until the early 20th century. And then it was a Nietzsche craze. There was another German philosopher, Friedrich Nietzsche, just another sort of raging intellect. But also anti-religious in lots of ways. And Kierkegaard became the religiously acceptable version of Nietzsche. So it's like, if you like Nietzsche, but you didn't like all the anti-Jewish, anti-Christian stuff, well, you could be Kierkegaard, you get Nietzsche, and you're now a hyper-Christian, you know? So it became sort of a theologically safe reading spot if you like Nietzsche. But go ahead, back there, yes, sir. Yeah, the devil.
It seems to me that he has just made the morality... to help your neighbor make this relationship with God. I don't see any justification as to why individuality is important. It seems to be sort of a semantic juggling here that he's pushed on a new his morality onto you.
Right.
I could flip a few words and the arguments would be the same.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose if you say that, you know, individuality isn't a priority, then you don't ever get going down this path, right? If you say this is really not an important value, don't get down the path. I mean, the big thing I want to make that ties to this theme of this week is that you can't be an individual without having the story, without making these sort of choices, without telling these stories, asking yourself where you're going, what are your basic values, and realizing that it involves making commitments and leaps that are only going to be cashed out in the way you live them. That's what's important for me for this week of themes I'm talking about. It doesn't have quite as an intense focus on individuality as Kierkegaard has. But that isn't such an extreme position, is it? To say that you should be reflective about your life, you should really have some sort of story to tell about where you're going, where you came from, and have acknowledged and accepted and embraced sort of the values that are behind that, and said, yeah, these are the values that make me who I am.
Hitler did it very well.
Yeah, well, he had one of those stories too. Yeah, the question is that the kind of story that can do the work we need to do, right? Right, he had a plan, certainly. But that's good, I got two more days, right? Friday, we're going to talk about what is it that makes a good self-interpretation, what is it that makes an interpretation a good interpretation? And hopefully that should rule out things like Hitler's kind of thing. But what you might want to say is that, and just to be all fair, that Hitler was a man who understood himself very well. You know, where is that? I don't know. Actually,
that's your argument.
I have no idea. Is that my argument? No, I have no idea.
You're just throwing that out so rhetorically.
I'm just throwing that rhetorically. Yeah. That's not my argument. Are we we're done. Yeah, thank you. Okay, sorry. The reason we all get quiet, let me go over. All right, thank you.